I miss a green, for example, I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
Fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
Welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast in our Superintendent Series. As always, today's episode is brought to you by Toro. Americans like our utility vehicles the way we like our U.S. Open courses. Rugged. A winner needs to do it all in tough conditions. And Toro's new Workman UTX line is here to get the job done. Any job. Ice and snow removal, tree maintenance, transporting equipment or materials, whatever you need, this commercial-grade, smooth-riding, four-wheel drive monster has your back. The Workman UTX's proprietary governing system unpairs ground speed and RPM so the operator can limit the machine's speed without gutting the power. Higher RPMs when more oomph is required, less RPMs and less fuel consumption when it isn't. That kind of all-around performance is what champions are made of. Follow at Toro Golf on Twitter and reach out to your local Toro distributor to schedule a demo. Today's episode is with Sandy Reed, the director of greenkeeping at St. Andrews Links. I met Sandy when I was over for the Open this year, and Sandy oversees all the courses at St. Andrews. So all seven, manages the entire team, and is a wonderful guy. Before St. Andrews, he worked at Carnoustie. So without further ado, here is Sandy Reed. All right, Sandy, obviously a crazy year for you. Can you give us an idea? You know, most people, I think, look at hosting one major tournament, one big event as a, you know, a big year. What's it like when you're doing two and you have the obviously the 150th Open and the last, just finishing up last week, the Dunhill? What's that like from a, you know, kind of a setup in a golf course strain perspective?
Yeah, well, I guess preparing for the Open, it doesn't really come any bigger than that, but, you know, preparations for that, they've been, you know, they're 3 or 4 years in the making, really. So pretty much our whole priority for the year was around just having the golf course set up for that, which we feel we did, you know, a reasonably good job at. As for the Dunhill, that, whilst it's a big DP World Tour event, it's actually pretty straightforward for us to prepare for. You know, at this time of year, the grass is almost stopped growing. There's no rough or anything to manage. The only thing we're really trying to do is make sure there's no disease on the greens, you know. So Dunhill's relatively straightforward. Everything that went into preparing for the 150th Open, you know, there's a lot of stuff goes into that, whether it be on the course or infrastructure. We're quite a complex site here with golf courses at either side of the old, so all the tentage and bits and pieces, you know, it impacts all the courses here. So that's where you know, that kept me busy for the first half of the year, that's for sure.
Yeah, how long was the infrastructure build out for the Open? It was huge, and how much time went into just putting it up?
So the contractors, they came on site on the 14th of March, is when they came on site. The build started first Monday in April, I'm going to say Monday the 4th, thereabouts. So yeah, there would be a good 3 full months of build. Now, if in the early weeks, it was fairly gentle. It was mainly grandstands in the early wee while. The tentage, it really ramped up in that last sort of 6 or 8 weeks out. The tented village, that sits on our driving range, our golf academy, that was a fairly substantial build, right enough. So we had to close that down just at the end of April, if I recall. So that was fairly complex. But yeah, I believe it was probably the biggest infrastructure there's ever been at the Open. I go to the Open every year pretty much, and I've worked at three at Carnoustie prior here, but you know, a different scale altogether.
So you've worked at Carnoustie and St. Andrews. We're going to take those away. What's your favorite? You mentioned going to the Open every year. What's your favorite venue, non-Carnoustie or the Old?
I would say Birkdale, probably. I've not played them all. I've played Muirfield, but I've only played his foursome, so I've only played nine holes, if you like. Half the course. Birkdale's probably my favourite out the rest. They're all great in their own way. I've not played St George's and not really got inside the ropes per se. I was at the Open there last year, but with the COVID restrictions, we didn't really get a great chance to get inside the ropes to really appreciate the course. But I would say Birkdale's probably my favourite out with the two that I've been at.
Back to the Dunhill and the Open. So did all the infrastructure come down and did new infrastructure go up? How did that work?
Yep, every single thing came down from the Open, albeit some of the actual equipment just got stored on site and then got rebuilt again, just in a slightly different location or on a smaller scale. Funny, you know, some of the contractors, it was the same guys, you know, and on the 26th of August, they officially finished with the R&A, and on the 29th of August, they started with IMG, who run the Dunhill. So same guys using the same stuff, but just building in a slightly different place.
That's funny. So they just bring it down, put it back up 3 days later. So you just, it's going to be like, what in terms of the turf and like having stuff on it for effectively almost a year now, what are you looking at in terms of just the damage done to it and the bounce back from it?
Yeah. It depends what infrastructure was on the turf. Where there was the grandstands or bleachers, that's pretty minimal. You know, there was still some daylight and air got underneath them. Where the tentage was and the trackway, you know, the metal trackway where all the big articulated lorries come in, that's really where we've lost a lot of grass. So on top of it being down for so long, we've had a very dry year, as you'd have seen at the Open. And it's actually continued to be a little bit drier than average, perhaps, post-Open. We've had some heavy spells of rain, but recovery has perhaps been a little bit slower than we would have perhaps anticipated. We, you know, been doing a lot of variation, a lot of seeding, a lot of feeding. But it's going to be well into next year before we get full recovery. You know, there's some areas where the hospitality was on the second hole of the Eden, which is quite bad. Some of the driving range where the tented village was. So yeah, it's there's some substantial stuff there. But here we've non-stop since the Open. The guys have been working on it, getting seed in the ground. So the challenge is we've had golf. You know, all this infrastructure and other golf courses. We have had golf on top of us. So you know, getting the opportunity to get in there and do the work and have the young grass get some, you know, time to itself without getting trampled has been the tough thing for us.
You effectively operate like the biggest municipal facility in the country. And I think, how hard is it to do course projects at a public golf course where you don't really have shutdowns? I think, you know, everybody always, and I'm one, is clamoring for, in America, at least, municipal golf to start to do some projects. But then, you know, the aspect of shutting down the tee sheet is a really difficult thing. How do you guys, you know, go about doing bigger projects, in this case, recovery from the tournament while people are, you know, playing and you have packed tee sheets?
Yeah, it can be quite tough. That's for sure. In fairness, we have, best part of 6,500 ticket holders that play golf here. So, you know, we have to communicate well with them. But, you know, generally everyone's been fairly helpful in that regard. You know, I talked about that hospitality tent on the second of the Eden. You know, we shortened it to par three in advance and we played it for a par three for a few weeks thereafter. And most people are pretty understanding. Winter time, it's similar. We have, you know, have some decent side projects on the go each winter time. We have a couple of sort of maintenance days through the winter that can help us just get some of the work done. or we just have to try and move the tee markers around best we can. The problem is we have got a few of the clubs, they still actually play handicap counting competitions here too, so there's challenges with around that. But we find a way, basically, you know, we'll work around the golf best we can, and generally there's not really an issue.
I want to talk a little bit about yourself. Where'd you grow up, and how did you get into golf?
So I grew up in, you could say, the central highlands of Scotland, a little village called Blairathal. So maybe almost halfway between Perth and Inverness. And so my father was a deer stalker. He looked, you know, after red deer and grouse on the moors. And I always thought I would be I'd follow him into gamekeeping. But I had played golf. He did golf. And so he would take my brother and I, my younger brother and I, golfing from, I'm going to say I started when I was around about nine, maybe. I forget. But a little nine-hole course. Nine-hole course at Blairathal. Great little course. And we had family friends that he was the head greenkeeper at Lochry Golf Course, which is another 10 minutes down the road. So when I was 14, he had asked if I was interested in some holiday work. So I jumped at that. So for 3 years, when I was 14, 15, 16, I worked at Easter and summer holidays at Putlochry. At the end of that, when it came time for me leaving school, I was never going to stay on too long at school. I kind of wanted to leave when I was 16. I decided I wanted to give greenkeeping a shot. Signed up for a one-year basic greenkeeping course at Elmwood College, which is actually not too far away from St Andrews here, only 15 minutes away from St Andrews. But signed up as a 16-year-old, did one-year basic kind of greenkeeping stuff, but stayed on site at college, loved it. And then I guess the fortunate thing for me was I got a job at the end of it. You know, you wrote a pile of letters away. One of the modules we did at college wasn't just greenkeeping. One was on communications and teaching you how to write a letter properly. And so I remember writing, I'm going to say it was like 27 or 28 letters to golf courses all around the sort of north and east of Scotland. That was kind of where my family were from and where we holidayed. I was more comfortable. I knew the golf courses. So that was the day, I guess there was typewriters, but I think I would have handwritten all these letters. Wrote 27 or 28. And I got one response, and the response was offering me a position. And this is where I think perhaps it may be a little bit of fate, good luck, whatever. I had put on the letter that I was from a gamekeeping family. So the guy that offered me a job, he was into his shooting and his dogs, training dogs and stuff. And I think rather than any of my greenkeeping qualifications, it was the fact that I said I was the son of a gamekeeper. It was probably kind of piqued his interest. And that was at a place called Letham Grange, which is probably, it's sadly closed down a couple of years ago, but that's maybe about 10, 15 minutes away from Carnoustie. So I was 3 years there and then fortunately got an assistant's job at Carnoustie. But before I finish, what I should say is that guy that offered me the job back in 94, he's now my father-in-law. So,
no way.
That's right. Yeah, I met.
So you got a job. You got a job, and you met your wife.
I met my wife there as well. Yeah, so we're still happily together. All this time later. Yeah,
that's wild. You know what an interesting way to get into the business, but also just, you know, what an amazing first job, right?
Yeah,
you know, changed your life really.
Yeah, absolutely.
In so many ways.
Yeah.
What you know, when you started working as a kid and during holiday and, you know, and part time, what was it about the jobs and working on the golf course that you liked and made you want to do that rather than, you know, kind of following in the family footsteps?
Well, I guess it was still an outdoors type thing. I think I really enjoyed the sense of achievement of doing a task and seeing it completed and, you know, enjoying the fruits of your labor, if you like. You know, there was almost a fairly immediate sense of satisfaction from completing a job. And in those days when I was at school, I wasn't really on any equipment. It was raking bunkers and brushing grass and stuff. But I think I just enjoyed kind of trying to do a job and doing it well. I think that's really the catalyst for getting me into it.
Mm-hmm. It's I think about that, like, I was out at a golf course this morning, you know, shooting some stuff, filming, and I was just thinking about, like, how when you're mowing a green, it's just like when you're mowing a yard, but that idea of, like, you can see the progress, and then you finish it, and it's very, like, kind of, it is rewarding. There is, like, a nice sense of accomplishment when you finish these types of things. And so how did you get looped in at Carnoustie? Was that, were you just looking for a new place to move up to? And that was, you know, how did that work?
No, that was, there was an advertisement in the local newspaper. I hadn't been looking for a job, but an advertisement came up, and I applied for it, and just got the job. It was fairly straightforward. What I do remember, I had one of the longest interviews in my life. So the superintendent at that point was a legendary greenkeeper in UK circles, a guy called John Philp, and he had pretty much transformed Carnoustie, if you like. You know, it was in a pretty sorry state when he took over in 85, and he had turned its fortunes around. It was just a big snowball effect. As it got better, it got more, you know, more visitors, more income, and we were able to spend more. But by that point, you know, I started there in 97. So at that point, they had already hosted two Scottish Opens in 95 and 96. The Open was coming around the corner in 99. So, you know, when the advert came up, I jumped at the chance at going for it. Had an interview with John that lasted, 2 or 3 hours, and I didn't do very much talking. I can tell you, he's John's one of the most enthusiastic guys you'll ever meet. So but I got the job there, and you know, just over the years, kind of managed to work my way up. But it's a real special place, Carnoustie. You know, I still hold it fondly in my heart. You know, all the work that we did there, and how good the turf is. I look at it, you know, from a turf manager, and it takes a bit of beating.
Yeah. With you, as you described John as a legend, you know, when you worked for him, what was kind of the biggest thing that you took away? How did he shape you as an individual?
He was a hard worker. I like to think I was a hard worker, but he I felt you could, he wouldn't necessarily pat you on the back, but you knew you were. I always thought I was kind of trying to please him, putting my best foot forward. I enjoyed my work too, but he was so enthusiastic about the turf and the game. He's a bit of a historian, you know. He really knows his stuff about the game, especially the Open, and you know, Tom Morris, and he could really talk about the history of Carnoustie, especially. But he was such an enthusiast for the turf, and the challenges he would have had to try and make it better. He was perhaps a little bit more, I don't know what word, not ruthless, but he didn't care so much about the golfers. He just got on and did the work, and you know, if there was flack coming his way, he just accepted it, you know, and just moved on. He knew he was doing it for the betterment of the course. So he you know, there was nothing really stopped him in terms of doing what he felt was best for the turf and turn the course. A real, just an enthusiastic guy about his vocation and the game. Two things I love myself.
For more than a century, with cutting-edge turf equipment and irrigation solutions, Toro has had your front nine covered and your back nine too. In fact, Toro's always had your back, period. Toro is as committed to your long-term success as Toro pros are committed to their shot. That's down to top-notch customer support from Toro and its dedicated local distributors, both of whom are passionate about delivering turf equipment and irrigation solutions that solve real-world problems. Follow @ToroGolf on Twitter and reach out to your local Toro distributor today. Now back to Sandy Reed. So you worked your way up and ran essentially the maintenance program at Carnoustie over the years. What were your, you know, favorite parts of Carnoustie, just as a place in general, and how you guys went about maintaining it?
Well, a couple of things I talked to earlier, you know, just the standards of turf quality, turf presentation there. It kind of almost became a little bit addictive, just trying to see how, you know, looking how, you know, figuring out ways we could make it better. You know, the attention to detail wasn't just in the turf, you know, bunker preparation, the bunker revetments. In my eyes, you'll not see bunkers built any better, you know, to a better quality. And the golf course, especially the championship course, there's three courses, 54 holes at Carnoustie, you know, three super courses. But the championship course, it's a special place, you know, it's real, you know, it's a test of your game for starters, but there's so many different challenges that it kind of throws at you. You know, the bunkering, as in the strategic element of the bunkering around there, takes a bit of beating too, you know. So, and you do know that it's, you know, there's so much history at a place as there is here, that people, loads of people in my shoes before me had similar challenges, more difficult challenges perhaps. But we're, you know, we're looking after our course. Now, all had their left their mark in some way or another. You know, had all looked to make some form of improvements, especially at Carnoustie. You know, there had been quite a few changes there over the years. Perhaps a little bit more difficult to achieve that sort of thing here at the old course.
With what you said about the bunkers, the best built bunkers, what makes them so well built?
I think it's just the sharpness, if you like, round the you know, how they fit into the ground. I guess where maybe Carnoustie does differ, though, a lot of the bunkers at Carnoustie aren't really pot bunkers per se. They're more up in your face. You know, here at St Andrews, a lot more of the bunkers probably sit down into the ground a little bit more, whereas at Carnoustie, they probably sit up. So, the you know, how you tie that into the ground perhaps is... can be a little bit more visually impressive, I guess. You know, you see more of the bunker. But the guys there, and that was well before my time, you know, they just built a good bunker. They, you know, they get their angles good, just the slopes of the tapers, the quality of turf, you know, the run-ins, you know, just the shapes that suits the ground, makes maintenance, I guess, easier too, gathers the ball in the right way. Here, loads of people build great bunkers, but when I go back there, yeah, I still look at them and think, yeah, I'd love to get to that stage here at St Andrews.
What would you say is, like, you know, in terms of when you think back to Carnoustie, what was the biggest challenge to presenting that golf course on a daily basis? What was kind of the thing that would keep you up at night?
I've often always said I don't know that I've ever been kept up at night thinking about turf. I've been kept up at night thinking about people, but I don't know that I've been kept up at night thinking about turf. But though, I guess in relation to that, it just you know, that you don't necessarily have a places, not just Carnoustie, a lot of links courses, a lot of courses around the world, I guess. But you know, the time that you've got in the morning. To do your prep and then golf right on the back of you. You know, even in the height of the summer, you know, you might only have an hour. And if you're trying to do maintenance, as in top dressing or spraying, and, you know, you really have to think on your feet. The amount of times that we would do stuff on a Sunday evening, you know, to try and get a head start. You know, Sunday evenings are might, you know, behind the last of the visitors, you'd make a head start to some of the spray operations or top dressing, at least get six greens done, just so that you had that head start in the morning to ensure you didn't get swallowed up by the golf the next day. So that was probably some of the biggest challenges, I would say.
Mm-hmm. What, you know, so you're running Carnoustie. How did the job at St. Andrews come up, and were you immediately interested? I imagine you probably, I can't imagine there's a job that's, you know, bigger or necessarily better. But like, walk us through that whole process.
Yeah. So there is a bit of a story to that. So you're right. It is, I guess in my eyes, it doesn't really get any bigger than St. Andrews, but also in my eyes, I was at the next best place at Carnoustie. You know, I had a great job there. We were very settled. You know, I've got a great wife and two super kids who were at that point 8 and 5, I think it was. So, a month. So I was preparing for the Open in 2018, and then 3 weeks before the Open. It was announced that Gordon Moyer, my predecessor here, he was going to be retiring, which he that in essence was early retirement. He was only 59 at the time, so not that I had ever caught myself thinking about St Andrews, but if I did, you know, I always thought, well, Gordon's got a long time before he would ever retire. So yeah, he announced just at the end of June, 2018, that he was retiring, and my head was a little bit scrambled, to be honest, because you're preparing for the Open, and then you're thinking, well, the only job that I would maybe ever turn my head is now up. And yeah, it took me a long time to figure out if I was ever going to apply for it. And you know, I had some conversations with agronomist John Philp, my former boss at Carnoustie, and it wasn't until my wife had said, look, I think you're going to have to go for it, that I did. You know, we had a few years earlier, we bought what we thought was our forever home as well, you know. So there was a lot in the mix. But so yeah, the interviews came around. I did absolutely no preparation for the first interview, because I still wasn't convinced that I wanted the job. It was right for me. So I did no preparation. That was a fairly relatively informal. That was with at that point Ewan Loudon. He was the former chief executive here at St Andrews Links Trust, and my predecessor Gordon Moyer. So it was more of a sit down chat with them. And then there was a second interview maybe a couple of weeks later. But by the time that came around, I was ready.
Was the first interview like in the lead up to the Open at Carnoustie, or was it after?
It was after. So
okay, I just was curious. I was like, well, you know what? Maybe
I've missed out a part of the story here. I'm getting carried away. So the closing date was the Friday after the Open. And I still hadn't made my mind up. The applications, there was no email applications, it was applications by post. So on the Thursday night before the closing date, I drove over from Carnoustie to St Andrews with my application, because I couldn't get it here in time. So it was really last minute that I made the decision to do it. So I
right under the wire.
Yeah, I drove over 8 o'clock on the Thursday night with my application. So that's how that came about. So and then the first interview must have been early August. So second interview came around. By that time I was ready. You know, I wanted the job. There was perhaps that competitive part too. You think, well, I want to make sure that I show that I'm the best. You know, I didn't know who would be applying for it, but you can. Perhaps there was that element too. But I was ready at that point to say, yeah, St Andrews is the job that I want. Unfortunately, that I came through that process that involved the chair of the trustees and the chair of the Links Management Committee, as well as chief exec and my former director of greenkeeping, and yeah, came through on top of that process. And it's been great.
So do you live in St Andrews proper?
Yeah, we moved over. So Carnoustie's not far. It's only maybe a 45-minute commute. But I guess that was one of the challenges when the job came up. I've always lived pretty close to my work, always within 5-10 minutes. And also at that point, my wife's health hadn't been so good. She wasn't driving through because of epilepsy, and I had the young kids. And I thought, well, if I was going to move work to St Andrews and my wife can't drive and the young kids need ferried about for some reason, I'm 45 minutes or an hour at night time from getting home from being able to help out. So I always felt that if I was to get the job at St Andrews, it meant moving home. So we're fortunate we managed to get a house in the town, just maybe 6 months after I started here. So it's great living in the town, it really is.
What's your favorite part about living in St Andrews? I feel like I didn't get like the normal experience, obviously, being there the week of the Open. It was a bit hectic, but it seems like an amazing town to live in.
Yeah, it really is. You know, it's like living in a city, but in small. You know, it's got a lot of amenities. There's a lot of things here that you can do, a lot of great places to eat and drink, a lot of good stuff for the kids, you know, activities for the kids. Obviously, golf courses on your doorstep, the beach, you know, West Sands is next to the golf courses here. Great place to come. Schools are good. It's just an all-round nice town.
What so you take over like a massive operation, and you obviously have how many people on staff do you have?
I have 69 permanent staff within the greenkeeping function.
What, you know, how do you implement change if you want to change something? Like, you know, obviously everybody's been doing things, you know, a certain way, and I imagine you come in and everybody's different. They, you know, you know everybody runs things a little bit differently. How did you go about that process of implementing the way you wanted things run with a staff that, you know, had been working for somebody else?
Yeah, I guess I would say, yeah, almost 4 years in, and I still wouldn't say that I've implemented too much in the way of change, but I don't know that I'm that way inclined. You know, it's a very similar position here than it was at Carnoustie. You know, you're in charge of multiple courses, but you've got superintendents underneath you. And I was in their shoes. I worked under John Philp at Carnoustie. I was looking after the championship course. But I didn't want John telling me what to do. You know, I wanted my place. I wanted the accountability, the responsibility of looking after the course. So I've always tried to manage my course managers or head greenkeepers that way, give them their space to do that. So if I'm looking to implement change, I'm not going and dictating stuff to them. I want them to have the freedom to manage things how they want, so long as the results are good, you know, and they're all doing a great job, but they just get there slightly differently, you know, in terms of how they manage their turf. But really for me, it's just about, it's having chats. It's been in the guy's ears, you know, and just, you know, it's, have you thought of this? You know, it's suggesting rather than dictating. But there has been one or two, you know, changes I have made. And I think, but I've, generally it's been through agreement with the guys too, you know, whether that be to structural elements in the team or even influence on the courses, you know, we're changing, you know, whether it be a couple of winter projects. But we kind of talk through it as a kind of a collective, really. But, you know, I like to make sure that I get their input. All the course managers, they've been here a lot longer. Most of them are older than me too. So, you know, they know the site well. They know it better than I do. So, I have to rely on them for a lot of that.
Your role in your role at Carnoustie, you're not day-to-day out, you know, looking at every golf course and examining it like you would as a course manager running your own golf course. You know, do you miss, and what aspects of being a course manager do you miss from your current job?
Absolutely, I miss it every day. I'm fortunately stuck in the office most of the week now. I think it maybe goes back to, I think, what I said earlier on about as a youngster, it's that sense of achievement, maybe achieving something physical. You know, that's what I miss. But even if I was to go back down a level to say when I was the head greenkeeper at the championship course at Carnoustie, I would view it as I had my plan, whether it be for a day, a week, a month, a year, a winter, whatever. I had my men, I had my equipment, you know, I had my materials, and you would plan around that, get your jobs done, and you could see that, you know, that reward of what you had in your mind, what the program you had ahead of you. So I miss that now. You know, the wins I get are they're not quite so tangible, if you like. It's not quite the same physical aspect. So I do miss getting out on the equipment or being involved in some of the day-to-day kind of running elements, but that just goes with the territory. You know, I enjoy seeing that I've perhaps had an influence on, you know, anyone on the team, not just the course managers or their deputies, but anyone that, you know, when I can, I try to speak to them, just even if it's just to pass the time of day, but trying to get to know them and, you know, figure out if I can help them in any way.
You said you give your course managers a lot of autonomy and let them kind of run their golf course, present their golf course the way they'd like to present it. Can you give us an example of how, you know, your different courses at St. Andrews differ just based off of the course manager and how, and their philosophy, how they present the golf course?
I'll start just to give you an idea of the different responsibilities they have, you know, in the team underneath me. So whilst there's seven courses, or six and a half, if you like, six 18s and a nine, it's not like I've got seven different course managers. So I've got a course manager for the old course. He just looks after that alone. There's a course manager who looks after the new and the Jubilee as one team. Now, he's in the same facility as the course manager on the old course. Then I've got a team that look after 45 holes, that look after the Eden side. That's a single team. And that two of their courses are built on slightly different grounds, still links, but it had formerly been agricultural ground, USGA or allegedly USGA greens on, you know, 27 of the holes over there. And then we've got the Castle course outside the town, which is completely different. It's built on clay, very much links style, but USGA greens up there. So they've all got slightly different things they need to look after and consider. I guess the closest ones really are the old, new Jubilee and the Eden. Would be, you know, proper old school links courses where they're 100 years plus old. So there, you know, a lot of similarities there. The old has more play than the rest, you know, and you know, the way it is built. You know, the trafficking on the old course is one of the key challenges. You know, everyone's off the one side of the green, and that's one of the main challenges they have. Expectations are obviously pretty high in the old course all year round. We have visitors, you know, 98% occupancy in the old course for the year. So the pressure to keep things, you know, presentable and in good nick. Well, it's the same across all the courses, really. But the new and the Jubilee, you know, they're and to an extent, they're perhaps, they've got even less time in the morning to prepare in front of the local golfers. They're getting chased around. You know, it might be a two ball that's out first, and they'll nip round and 2.5 hours, you know, and it's so it can be tough for the guys to get that opportunity to do their sort of maintenance, so they have to kind of box clever there. Eden side's similar, and then you've got the team numbers as well. So that pound for pound, the old course has got the most men per hole, if you like. You know, it's got the four teams are almost comparable in size, but they look after a different amount of golf holes. But there's a lot of different challenges, a lot of different competitions they all have to deal with. Castle closes in the for 4 months in the winter time, which helps them. But then they've got the pressure of making sure everything's right all the way through this summer. It's a lot of visitors go up there too. But they don't get any maintenance done. Their seeding work they'll do when the course closes in early November, rather than in the what we might call the growing season. So a few different challenges across the four teams, really.
Do you notice a difference in how, like, do the managers of those facilities, just how they go about process, or are you guys trying to present as similar conditions across the courses as possible?
We are trying to present similar conditions, but they definitely have different processes. They're different outlooks on, you know, nutrition, wetting agent. Top dressing is all very similar, you know, or sand inputs in terms of the targets for organic matter in the greens, but they all have all the course managers have a slightly different style, which is fine because the results that they're achieving are all first class in my eyes. So I'm fine with that.
Obviously, something a big topic has been climate change, and I'm curious if climate change or the threat of it has impacted how you guys do your job or the maintenance of the course, and if you've planned for any of the effects of it.
Yeah, it does seem to be having a little bit of effect. What I guess perhaps more of it's anecdotal, but what we're finding is the spring seems to be colder and longer than it has been in the past, which has meant growth is a little bit behind getting into the season. You're finding that winters are generally slightly milder, and then rainfall, you've seen this year, it's been a, you know, what we call a drought. But what you're finding, it's kind of feast or famine. You know, you'll get prolonged periods of dry weather, and then all the rain will come at once. So I wouldn't be surprised by the year end, we're back to our average in terms of rainfall, but it'll all have fallen in a sort of shorter window of time.
What part of the property is most susceptible to the erosion? What part of the, I guess, obviously the beach, but then maybe the golf aspect?
The most delicate bit is probably it's actually on the Eden estuary. So on the sort of, it wouldn't be a million miles away from, say, the eighth tee in the old, if you went up along east a little bit from there. So, you know, right behind the 11th green on the old, you know, we've got gabion baskets along the Eden estuary, and that they end another maybe 300-400 yards up, 400 yards beyond that. So immediately as you get beyond the Gabion baskets, there's a, as you can imagine, there's a weak area there where this, you know, the water, there's a bit of water ingress. It also is in alignment with the actual burn, the river course of the Eden that comes through the Eden estuary. It puts a little bit extra pressure on that dune there. So and the wind, the way the wind batters there. So that's our probably our weakest spot. That's formerly had two beach recharges, you know, perhaps best part of 20,000 tons of sand driven in to almost recreate the dune and the beach there. And that's another thing we're planning for in the next few years. So it's a case of just holding the line, if you like, really just trying to maintain what we have there. Some further round in the Eden estuary, actually, on the Eden course, you know, that's perhaps we might be most susceptible to a coastal flood. I think 2010 was the last bad one we had there. Down at the Swilkin, you know, there was a bad one there again. Maybe it was the same time, 2010. There was a bit of dune loss there, but that was recharged, and that's, you know, that's actually growing. You know, we're accreting ground there, but you might say, you know, the Swilkin is tidal, and some high tides, the tide can come right up there. Doesn't quite burst through its banks, but maybe if you had a bad coastal storm, it potentially could. But I would say Eden estuary is actually the sort of most delicate point for us just now.
What's your favorite part of the property? If you were going to go for a walk, where would you want to walk?
I guess anywhere along that Eden estuary and right out to what we call the outhead. It's the point at where the Eden estuary meets the North Sea, if you like. Right out there, out by, you know, the 8th Union of the Jubilee. Beautiful spot out there. You know, you kind of look over to Lookers and Tentsmuir Forest. See right back down into the town. You see back down through the golf courses. So probably that's the nicest spot. You know, there's a little bit of height there as well. It just helps you see a little bit more of the ground around about you.
So that's where you'd go if you were going on a Sunday stroll.
Yeah, you would go, or, and often it might be up, just walking up the beach, you know, all the way up the West Sands beach, and then just nip round the corner up and into the dunes. Yeah, that would be, it's a popular spot, and I'm no different, really.
Tell us about how being closed in a park on Sunday impacts maintenance. Obviously, I think that was one of the things that had the biggest impact on me was the idea of the major championship ending. And I walked out of the media center maybe 2 hours after, and people are all over the course. People are having effectively like a picnic in the pot bunker on the 17th hole. You know, kids are hitting golf shots. I mean, it was such a neat scene and atmosphere. And, you know, I think America, that doesn't happen really at any golf courses. And most would say, point to, nobody's going to take care of the course and it's going to get beat up. Does it make more work for you guys? Like can you just maybe just talk about Sunday close being closed?
Yeah. Well, so Sunday, it's closed to give it a rest, as old Tom Morris would have said, but it probably, the old course probably gets more people walking a Sunday than it does Monday to Saturday combined when you see it. In fairness, most people are pretty respectful. You know, we have people and dogs and bunkers and stuff. You know, we always know that on a Monday morning there's going to be some extra work. But, you know, fortunately, you know, there's not too much in the way of other damage goes on. Folk are generally fairly respectful. We do use it as an opportunity to do some of the maintenance on the old. You know, if we have top dressing operations or spray operations and, you know, and the weather's conducive, we'll try and achieve that on a Sunday morning. So we'll generally have a few more staff in on a Sunday than we would on a Saturday when there's still play on. So, yeah, we use Sundays as an opportunity to get some work done, I guess, early on as we too, because there's still public come out. But I tend not to come down on a Sunday because it does up. You know, I'm not necessarily used to seeing that many people on the course at once. It would just get me upset when I see, you know, kids in bunkers and dogs running right and skidding, picking up balls. So I tend not to come down and look at it. But, you know, in fairness, it causes a very little issue. And it's great. It's a great thing for the community, you know, and it's not just the local community. There's plenty of others come. But I think, you know, it's great to be able to share our facility with other people. It's a beautiful spot to walk, you know.
I'd imagine that, you know, part of the reason that it's worked where you haven't had like major problems is that it's, you know, the fact that it's open every Sunday creates almost like a, it's like, it's a normal place to go. And there isn't any, you know, and there's a lot of pride, obviously, within the community for it, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. You're right. You know, if you are down at, you know, you see a lot of similar people out, certainly in the early stages of a day. And I think you're right. You know, it's, the Lynx is really, you know, it's, we're sort of, the Lynx Trust, we're custodians of it, if you like, on behalf of the people of the town. So everyone in the town appreciates what the course is here, you know, the Lynx is for them, is for the town. So yeah, people do, they do appreciate it. They do respect it.
What's the best time to visit outside of, you know, summer?
If you're going to golf or if you're just going to come and visit? Because I would say for golf, your best time, I would say September's a great month. You know, in the UK in general, I would say September's a great month for golf, especially in the Lynx course. The fescue's really kind of really strong in September, you know. I would also say September's a great time. It would be one of my favourites, I would say. But you can get some great weather. You know, partly in September there, but other than Friday, you know, the Dunhill, we had some great weather at the Dunhill there. Some great, you know, the sun's just that little bit lower too, you know, cast the shadows over the place, again, it shows it off at its best. So I would say early autumn, yeah.
When those shadows come, it's unbelievable how spectacular it is. We saw how brown, you know, I don't know if baked out is the best term, but just how brown, how fast the golf course played at the Open. It was incredible. You know, what type of strain at that point was put on the grass? Like, what were you ever, you know, were you, you know, you and the team ever worried about the grass? And then how long did it take to bounce back? And like, what are we talking about in terms of recovery? Like the moment the tournament ended, what was going on?
Yeah, things were very dry. And if we were talking about well, I'll talk a little bit about the run up. It was a very dry year from sort of April, really. It has been a very dry year, but we were keeping moisture levels where we were, you know, within target. We still had play right through till the sort of end of the third week of June. So we're having to maintain the turf for just the challenges of that. But we always know that turf can, given the right weather, turf in the Lynx environment can dry out pretty quick. And we were always, you know, obviously in conjunction with Arne, looking to try and get a firm, fast course. And that's years in the making through top dressing. You know, even had it been a green course, it would have still been quite firm. But we had managed that moisture, you know, kept it at a level, and then just gradually brought it down. And we had a target in our heads, you know, where we would like to be, to, you know, with a moisture to get a certain firmness on the greens. But in reality, we actually got drier. We were able to keep things drier and firmer than we thought we could while still maintaining control of the turf. So the challenges you've got, you know, if things get drier, things get faster and firmer. But if it gets that dry, your speed can sometimes get out of control. You know, you can't slow up again. But fortunately, you know, we worked really closely with the Arne agronomy team. We were taking moistures twice a day, really targeting in, you know, certainly through the week before the championship and championship week. We revised our targets down the way, more lower than Gordon McKee, the course manager, and I would probably have ever envisaged or been comfortable with in the past. But when you see how you know, we had the resource to our disposable to manage it, you know, with all the hand watering in the evening, and we were able to keep things really quite you know, dry and firm, but be in complete control of green speeds. It was quite rewarding. But yeah, it'd be lying if you said you weren't concerned that you might not get the bounce back. But you know, as for the bounce back, you know, no problem at all. You know, the sprinklers went on the Sunday night. Really, I guess that was the start of it. We got some rain the following week.
Yeah, I was staying in the dorms, looking out. I was looking out over 1 and 18, my window. And I remember I woke up Monday, and I felt, you know, every morning I'd look out at the course, and I felt like it had already started to have a little bit different color profile than the days before.
Yeah, it did, things had been, like I say, things had been dry early on. And I'm trying to think, I'm going to say it was 2 weeks before the Open, 2.5 weeks before the Open. There was a wet weekend that we had, and it just kind of set us back a little bit. We thought things were just dialed in fine. We were just managing that moisture down. And then we had a weekend, a lot of rain, and things really greened up. And we didn't really know if things would get back to where they had been, but it turns out they did. You could see every day things just drying out. You're right, through championship days as well. You could tell the difference. There wasn't much grass coming off the surface, as I can tell you that. I had similar Carnoustie in 2018. It was a similar kind of thing back then. And funny enough, though, there was probably slightly more intense heat back in 2018, which some of the fescue, a lot of golf courses in the UK suffered with recovery in 2018 versus this year. From what I'm hearing, there was a lot of the fescue really struggled then. This year, it seems to have coped a little bit better. I can't speak forever. I know down in South England, some of the drought's been real bad this year, and maybe they've lost a little bit more grass than we have up here. But no, in general, recovery's been has coped and been quite good.
So next year, no championships. 2024, you got the women's Open. What is next year? Just I imagine going to feel a little bit like a breeze compared to this year.
Yeah, well, we do have the Walker Cup next year on the old.
Oh, forgot about that.
Yep. So that's exciting.
Unbelievable.
That's hopefully relatively straightforward to prepare for. It's just early September. But that's
it's
a great thing.
It's going to be like the easiest. This is going to be the least amount of play ever on the old course for a week.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And they play foursomes, is it? There's only four matches out, and then there'll be other 10, is it 10 singles? I forget each day. But we do have that. Although, like I say, that should hopefully be relatively straightforward to prepare for. It's the same time we have the RNA autumn meeting to prepare for at the start of September every year anyway. So it would just be, keeping things that a little bit finer in advance of that. But yeah, it's a busy year. Bookings are sort of through the roof. We expect it to be a busy year on the course. We've got the women's in 2024 thereafter.
Match play at the old course is, it might be, everybody talks like, oh, it's a great match play. Like, there might not be a better match play course in the world than the old course.
That's right. It is a great course anyway, but that strategic element, there's so many different ways you can play some of the holes, and yeah, I can imagine there'll be some great matches with that. So yeah, it's something we're really, really looking forward to. It's we've held a lot of Walker Cups here in the past, but it was a long time ago, it's great to have them back here.
Do you think they'll get a little bit more creative with setup, like using some different tee boxes for that? Obviously, they won't have to worry about scoring and people going bananas low.
I should imagine so. I know, again, I keep harping back to Carnoustie, but we had the amateur championship in 2015 there, and mixed things up a little bit there. Like, say, the third hole would put the tee markers forward to have them, have a go at the green. I know some of the pros did it off the back tee anyway in 2018, but I should imagine for a match play that there'd be some of the holes that might entice them into some sort of different shot. I guess just have to wait and see, but I should imagine so.
All right, well, thank you so much, Sandy. It's been great chatting with you. People can find you, obviously, buried in the offices at St. Andrews, but I appreciate the time. It was great meeting you this summer, and I was glad we could do this, and congrats on really a terrific year in terms of championship golf and golf on TV. But, from everything I hear from people that have been over there, it's, the maintenance levels of all the courses have been just tremendous. So I appreciate your time and look forward to more conversations in the future.
Thanks very much, Andy. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you for listening to another edition of our Superintendent Series. Today's episode was edited by Meg Atkins. Thank you, Meg. And as a quick reminder, go visit the Fried Egg Pro Shop. We got a ton of new stuff. Unfortunately, we don't ship to the UK for all the UK listeners. Maybe we'll get that done. If you like what we do and you are in America, in the United States of America, it would be great if you supported us through our Pro Shop. All the proceeds there go to us continuing to grow and staff up and do more and produce more golf content. So we've got hats, shirts, all kinds of stuff in there, prints. The Pro Shop is at proshop.thefriedegg.com. Thank you for listening to The Fried Egg, and we'll be back with another episode later this week.